This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Life may be full of good intentions, but it's sometimes also filled with unintended consequences. And today we bring the two together. Our guest today got a law degree, but then decided not to take the bar exam, moving instead to his family's home in the mountains of North Carolina to try his hand at writing. Then he received a phone call from a 14-year-old girl about what a local mining company was doing on the top of a nearby mountain. That's when J. Erskine Lutze used his legal background to take on both the company and the state of North Carolina. The end result is that he saved a mountain and a small community from an environmental nightmare. Then he wrote a book about his experience, returning him to his original reason for moving to the mountains. To write, Stand Up That Mountain, The Battle to Save One Small Community in the Wilderness Along the Appalachian Trail is the book, and J. Lutze joins us to share that story with us this hour. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. It's nice to come down off the mountain this morning.
Well, you're pretty much as tall as the mountain. I got to tell you that. You're a tall guy.
I'm a tall guy. At public hearings, I stood out for more than one reason, I guess.
Yeah. You've become, I'm told, a leading voice for state and federal conservation funding for investment in public lands. You're a trustee for Southern Appalachian Highlands Conservancy, one of the nation's most established land trusts. You've testified before Congress on the need for conservation funding, and you're a national spokesman for the Land and Water Conservation Fund. Is all of this the result of this battle you undertook for these folks in the mountains, or were you that involved prior to that?
That's a good question. I was not that involved prior, except to the extent I was leading hikes for the Nature Conservancy and for Southern Appalachian Highlands Conservancy. I was interested in taking people to beautiful protected places from the time I moved back to this mountain cabin where I'd spent my summers as a child. Mm-hmm. And I think once the case got started, I was looking for a way to continue to contribute, and I decided that buying land, identifying it using strategic tools that we use in the conservation community, was a less expensive, less arduous, less painful way of protecting sacred places than bringing a lawsuit every time a state agency screws up, although both are important.
I know a lot of people who got a law degree and then didn't go and take the bar exam, didn't become a lawyer. Why didn't you? Because that seems like a very tough course of study to then just walk away from.
It's actually a wonderful course of study for people who don't intend to practice law, because I think you study differently. Mm-hmm. A lot of my classmates knew on the first day that they were seeking this job or that job in the future, and they were lining up their summer internships from the first day of class, knowing – well, not knowing what I was going to do with my degree left me free. And I actually took writing classes while I was in law school. So to some, I might have seemed unfocused while I was in school, but I was really there to broaden my education. I felt after my 4 years of undergraduate education, I still had trouble reading the newspaper and understanding exactly what was going on with politicians in Raleigh and Washington. And I used that time to get smarter.
I often have that same problem, and I wonder if it's the way the articles are written.
Part of it's just a lack of vocabulary, and law school teaches you a vocabulary that is helping to run the nation, and I found that useful.
Okay. Let's go back to the very beginning of your story, and you're up in the mountains, and you get this phone call, and that's what started all this, a phone call from a young girl named Ashley Cook. She was 14 years old at the time, and she wanted to talk to you about Paul's crusher. You didn't know who Paul was, and I'm sure you didn't know what a crusher was. How did she know so much as a 14-year-old that she not only knew the law when she got on the phone with you about what this guy was doing that it was against the law? How did she know about that, and also be able to tell you what she and her family were up against?
Well, first, I should tell you that I did not know she was 14 years old. I assumed I was speaking to a grown woman who had some advanced degree. Mm-hmm. When she called me and she began articulating specific violations of North Carolina's Mining Act of 1971, which I had never heard of. And so after she detailed some of this, I asked to meet her. The next day when I met her is when I discovered that she was a 14-year-old child who was being homeschooled by her Aunt Ollie, and her uncle Curly, and they had given her a dial-up internet connection. And she had sat there on her own initiative, suspecting that the Mining Act was being violated, and found it in the general statutes and printed a copy and began marking it up. And on that day, she handed me that marked up copy of our Mining Act and really changed the course of my life.
In the course of that conversation on the phone, and you were a total stranger. You did not know each other. And she didn't know you. And we can talk about how she found you and why she called you. But in the course of that conversation, she passed the phone over to her Aunt Ollie. I didn't ask you this before we started the conversation, and I should have. Would you mind reading a piece of that conversation? Because I just think if you read from that little arrow in the book there, on that we'll get an interesting idea of the tone of the conversation that day and what happened going forward with these people.
I'd be glad to read a little bit. Aunt Ollie took a deep breath. "We're in trouble," she said before pausing. Was she smoking? She might have paused to pull on a cigarette. "We're barely hanging on," she said. "Paul's killing us." "All right," I said, "but who is Paul?" "Oh, Jesus, son," she exclaimed at my lack of knowledge. "Paul owns that rock crusher over across from my house. He's killing us. You don't know Paul Brown?" "Paul Brown," I thought to myself, scrambling to repair my credibility. "Clark Stone Company," I said. "I do know of him." "Well, you're going to know Paul real good before this thing is over," she said, "because he's going to pull that whole mountain down." "So I hear," I said. "What can I do for you?" "Well, now, what we need for you to do, if you'll do it, is to come to the county commissioner meeting. I don't know if we need a lawyer or a preacher or an undertaker, but Sam Laws has got this thing all lined up the way he wants it. But the thing is, don't Avery County have a ridge law?" "North Carolina has a ridge law," I said. "I don't know about the county." "Well," she said, "if I'd knowed what to do, I'd have already done it."
What went through your mind as this conversation between these two people, Aunt Ollie and initially Ashley, began in your head?
I saw an opportunity that I did not expect to encounter, because at this point I was being awakened every morning at about 6:30 with backup beepers from across the valley. Uh-huh. And from my house, where I was trying to sit at my typewriter and write in silence, perfecting the craft of writing fiction, I could feel the trees leave the sky and hit the forest floor. And all of a sudden, there was this woman who had a tangible claim. And I thought, if what I already fear is coming with this mine and what they seem to know, if we put this together, we may have a team that can create hope that we can fix it.
You describe Paul Brown, the fellow that she refers to in this book, as the richest man in the mountains, a businessman, and apparently, at least according to your book, a man who regularly cut corners to get business done, ignored the legal process of getting permits, and left destruction in his wake. Who is Paul Brown? Assuming he's still alive.
Paul Brown has actually passed away.
Okay.
And Paul was an interesting, enigmatic character. He was, I think of Paul as being old school. He started in the mining business when you didn't need permits, and he never quite got used to the idea that there was as much scrutiny of his operations as there came to be. Paul lived at a time and was born at a time when North Carolina had about 1.5-2 million people, and North Carolina now has 9 million people. And we've got new ways for managing extraction of resources. And Paul could not catch up to that. He was of goodwill. He was an old-timer. I liked Paul. We got along. We talked in the hallway at every hearing where we both appeared. But we were on opposite sides of this.
Was he angry? Was he puzzled? Was he perplexed? I mean, how did he handle you and others coming after him for this?
Paul was baffled.
Okay.
He was baffled that this had happened. As he said in a deposition, "I asked for a permit. They give me a permit. I ain't done nothing illegal." So Paul summed it up very simply. He had submitted an application. It was stamped, and he was ready to go. Furthermore, Paul was very frustrated that I had come into his life because it was costing him a lot of money. Mm-hmm. He said, "Now, Jay, I've got a lot of money. I've got deep pockets. But them lawyers has got long arms.
So you like the guy. That's it. That's very interesting. You went to they asked you to go, Ashley and Aunt Ollie and others asked you to go to a county commission hearing about this, a meeting. And you said, okay, but you brought, even though you have a law degree, you brought an attorney with you. That night pretty much changed the course of your life. How did you let that happen?
There was blindly, I can assure you. I rose to speak before the county commissioners, and I got a cold response. I was warned by the county manager to let my conscience be my guide if I wanted to say anything about the Putnam mine. And then I had the chair of the commission scratch his head and say, we can't do nothing about the Appalachian Trail. But a reporter was in the room. The reporter heard this conversation and said, I think there's a story here. What happened? And I explained it to him. And I think seeing me talking to a reporter, the county attorney came over and said, I think you have a lawsuit on your hands. And here is how you would sue the county if you wanted to.
The county attorney volunteered that?
The county attorney volunteered this, and I guess he assumed this was coming. Maybe it was in the air. Maybe it had been more controversial before we raised our question than I realized. This mine had already attempted to go into two different places, and one time they encountered a federally endangered bat species in the old Cranberry iron mine, and another time they pushed an illegal haul road up a creek that was a wild designated trout stream, and the state made them vacate that spot. So this mine already sort of had a target on it.
And let's back up. When he did that, Paul Brown, when he drove whatever equipment, he drove up this creek bed, which was an active creek bed. It wasn't a dry creek bed. It was active. It was a trout stream. He did it without permit. He did it without permission. He did it without thinking. It's just the way he did things, going back to the old-timey ways of doing things, and somehow got caught. This only happened because he lost his lease on the very first area that he was mining in, and it was completely legal there.
That's right.
But they changed their mind. The owner of the mountain changed their mind, and he dismantled his operation and moved it.
His prior site became the site for the new Avery County Hospital in Linville.
Okay.
And so he had to vacate that site.
This is, we should tell people, this all took place in Avery County. And a lot of people go up to Avery County on the weekends or whenever they can get away from the city, particularly down here, to get out of the heat. It's always 67 degrees or something like that up there. And a lot of people, a lot of wealthy people, have homes in that area. But they aren't the mountain people. They're the day people. They the weekend people. You seem to really, and I guess the people who go up there think they know the mountains. You really know the mountains, both geographically, topographically, and the people who live there. Talk about the people who live there, the mountain people, not the people who come up there for the weekend.
So my parents put me in the back of our family station wagon in Chapel Hill as a child with my brother and sister before you had to wear seatbelts. And
I did what I told you I wasn't going to do. I led you down a garden path with a question you can't answer before the break, so I'll stop you here. And we'll come back and we'll get the other side of that answer after the break. Our guest today is Paul J. Erskine Lutze. Stand Up That Mountain is the name of his book, and we're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Actors Theater, presenting Bloody, Bloody Andrew Jackson, a high-octane rock musical that reimagines the nation's 7th president as a rock star maverick. September 12th through October 5th, details at atcharlotte.org. And Signature Healthcare, celebrating 10 years of offering concierge medical care, providing patients with 24/7 physician access, personalized executive healthcare, and same-day appointments. SignatureHealthcare.org. It could be argued that the world's favorite drink is coffee. It also seems to have beneficial health properties, although that's certainly important. I suppose we're going to concentrate tomorrow on the search for the perfect cup, from different roasts and blends to the different types of beans, even different ways of brewing. They all contribute to this quest for the perfect cup, and we will find out more and do a little tasting ourselves tomorrow at 9.
NSA's surveillance network can tap into about 75% of all U.S. internet traffic. New details on how the program operates and its reach into the lives of ordinary Americans.
Join in on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon right after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Jay Lutze is our guest. Stand Up That Mountain, The Battle to Save One Small Community in the Wilderness Along the Appalachian Trail is the name of his book, which he'll be signing at Park Road Books tonight at 7 o'clock. I asked you before the break to talk about the mountain people, the people who have lived there literally for generations, and these are the people who contacted you to help them in this battle against this mining operation on top of a mountain. What don't we know about these folks?
I think it surprises people that the people living in Avery County, Mitchell County, Yancey County, Madison, some of our mountain counties, are still divided by ridgelines, and their culture tends to flow with their creek. And people on Roaring Creek, which tend to come from a couple of family lines, the Hugheses and the Burlesons, they have their own distinct dialect, mm-hmm. and people on Big Horse Creek, 6 miles away, say they can barely understand the people on Roaring Creek. There's a distinct language, the distinct ways of gathering. People tend to organize themselves by family and by clan and by church family, and that's very important. These are generalizations, but it's something that I grew up witnessing on Birchfield Creek. With my neighbors on that side of the county, tend not to join civic organizations. They tend not to be very invested in Newland because Newland is our county seat, but it's 4 miles away. And that's where you go if you're in trouble with the law, mm-hmm. or if you have to go to the grocery store. But they don't organize their life around their county. They organize their life around their family.
Was Paul Brown a mountain person, or was he an outsider?
Paul Brown is a mountain person from another part of the mountains.
I see.
He comes from over in Zionville, and that's a very intact mountain community, and his family was deeply rooted there. But when he came across the mountains to our neck of the woods, he came with myths surrounding him. Ollie said he's the biggest thing in the mountains, and you can't ever roll Paul Brown.
So you occasionally slip into the accent of these folks, and the reason I wanted you to read a little piece of that opening conversation was to give people the flavor of how they spoke, and you just mentioned that sometimes these folks speak in a way that just people on a different mountain can't understand them, and from the outsider's point of view, that can be viewed as not very smart, ignorant, and maybe they're pushovers. I'm just curious if Paul Brown thought that these people were pushovers or he just had been used to doing business this way over and over and over again.
I believe that Paul, as a mountain person, knew that people tend to respect and fear authority when it comes into the valley. And it can lead to aggression. But I think Paul thought this valley was easy pickings. Mm-hmm. And I think the state of North Carolina, frankly, was shocked when people from this little community who were denied their right to a public hearing before this permit was issued rose up the way that they did. In fact, they challenged me. They said, Jay, we understand why you're upset about this permit, but we're not hearing from anybody but you and one local family. And so we packed that courthouse with people who actually stood up for what they believe, that this is a special place, not only because people come from around the world to hike the Highlands of Rhone, the Appalachian Trail in that section to gaze at Grandfather Mountain and Mount Mitchell, but because it is intrinsically valuable. Mm-hmm. And the people that live there know that now.
For people listening to this conversation, where locate this? For people who go to the mountains and know something about Linville and maybe that area, locate where this was taking place, where this mine was.
This was on Bellevue Mountain, which lies, it's a 4,400-foot peak in elevation. It lies between Hump Mountain, which is the eastern edge of the Highlands of Rhone, which basically comprises the Tennessee-North Carolina border mm-hmm. in Avery County, lies between Hump Mountain and Grandfather Mountain. So if you're standing on Hump Mountain on the magnificent open grassy ball looking east, and you can see for about 60, 70 miles on a clear day, you're looking at Grandfather Mountain, Hawksbill, Table Rock, the Limble Gorge area.
And Paul Brown was not mining for gold or iron or emeralds. He was mining for gravel. And you stress that you quickly came to understand the importance that gravel plays. I never thought about this in modern society. It literally keeps us out of the mud.
It does indeed. And that is why so much power and money follows the supply of rock in every county. And it's often hidden behind trees where this mining takes place. In lower elevations, you might live near a gravel quarry and have no notice of it because it's within a larger tract of property behind berms. But in the mountains, an opening on top of a mountain, which is where the best grade of granite is to be found, can raise a lot of unhappiness in the local community. But it does. Our roads, our parking lots, whether they're paved or gravel, they all have gravel and crushed stone in them. It's important. I live on a gravel road.
So you and others understood the importance of the operation that this man had been conducting for years, and even what he was doing on the top of the mountain, but he needed to be doing it legitimately, and according to him, he had a permit to be there. In fact, he did have a permit to be there, which was approved, I'm told, in record time with, as you mentioned a second ago, no public hearing. And worse, state officials never visited. They were up in Raleigh, comfortably ensconced, and they never came down to see it and what the impact would be on the mountain. Is that unusual, or is that what the way these things are usually handled?
Well, at the time, that division of land resources was in charge of looking after 800 mining sites in the state with a very small staff, as I was constantly reminded by that very small staff.
Mm-hmm.
And they were not able to get out and do a thorough analysis of every site, unfortunately. That is only getting worse. With state budget cuts, there are fewer inspectors. There is less scrutiny of operations like this. And when you try to do this work, sitting at a desk, looking at a map, if you don't have the updated map that shows the correct location of the Appalachian National Scenic Trail in its current location where it's been since 1983, you might miss how close to a national park you're putting a mining operation.
Their maps would be that out of date. 1983 was a century ago, literally. They're that out of date?
Imagine a situation, a credenza filled with maps where a state official just wants to check off and make sure a terrible mistake isn't being made. I believe that they made an assumption that the Appalachian Trail was where it used to be.
In the chapters that you write about your relationship and your conversations with and your urging for these state officials to come to the mountain and see what you saw, you and others saw, they seem at times to be skeptical, reluctant, combative, cooperative, understanding. I mean, they're all over the map.
This is really why I wanted to write a book about the case, Mike, because there were very fine people, good public servants, caught up in a difficult situation that they did not want to be in. That is why sometimes they were combative, sometimes they were embarrassed. These are real rich people, just like Paul Brown is a real rich person.
Rich in terms of?
A good guy,
okay,
a bad guy. Okay. We all have these competing parts of our personality. And as a writer, I wanted to explore that because I knew that Charles Gardner, who issued the mining permit, was not just a cardboard cutout bad bureaucrat. He was more than that. I went to his house. He baked me a loaf of bread. These are fascinating people. Nor are Ollie and Ashley pure and good all the time. They stretched and bent and looked for ways to undermine this operation, and I thought that made them more interesting too.
Okay. Talk to me about what this mining operation looked like. Why this concerned people? Because as you say, there are these quarries all over the mountains. That's where we get a lot of the stone that we use. So why was this one egregious?
It's a great question. The Appalachian Trail is 2,400 miles long between Georgia and Maine. A lot of it is in the woods. in this one section for 17 miles, the Appalachian Trail is on top of the mountains on open grassy meadows. And it is a place where people who start their trail hike in Georgia, they've walked about 440 miles by the time they get to the Highlands of Rhone. And when they step into these open pastures at 5,900 feet of elevation, it is a balcony on the world. The views are breathtaking. And people literally, since the 1700s, have been coming there either to count rare plants and name new species or just to let their spirits soar.
You mentioned in the book that this is the one place, what, on the eastern seaboard or in the United States or in the world, I forgot which it is, that has more different species in one location than any other place in the world. That's what you said, right?
It is a botanical hotspot. And if you walked from the point in question on Hump Mountain to Grandfather Mountain, you would walk past more species of hardwood trees in that 8-mile walk than is on the entire continent of Europe. I talk a lot about people fighting for their own backyard, and environmentalists often get accused of just fighting for their own backyard. My backyard happens to be a sacred repository of some of the rarest plant species left on Earth, Arctic relic species pushed into the south during the last ice age that persist there because of the open grassy balds, the high elevation, and the southerly nature of the place.
In fact, these open grassy balds are alleged to have been created by the bison. Is that – well, not bison. The
woolly mammoth.
Woolly mammoth, yes. Really?
Yeah. These were – if we were to go back in time 12,000 years, North Carolina would have had a lot more openings than the forest cover has now. It wasn't a broadly forested area. It was an area of savannas and prairie-type conditions around Winston-Salem, for example, and a lot of openings were larger, kept open by fire in some places and by large grazing herbivores in other places. And then after the woolly mammoth was extinct, bison and elk kept a lot of the open areas open. But European settlers did a very good job of eradicating those species in the 1700s.
So we've gotten sidetracked. We've gone down a side trail here. Let's go back to what this thing looks like. You step out onto this grassy expanse, and then the views are amazing. And what did it look like, and what would it have looked like today had they been allowed to continue their operation?
From the spot of the Appalachian Trail where the case was based and our complaint took issue with the issuance of the permit, the first opening was 8 acres. And to mine, you first remove all the trees and then you basically vacuum it and remove the soil overburden to get to the rock. Mm-hmm. And then you dynamite and you blow the rock out of the mountain and you send it down the hill on conveyor towers. So after about 6 months of working at the site, you had blinking conveyor towers, large crusher jaws, and in hoppers, huge metal hoppers, and trucks coming and going from the site, and backup beepers. And then the mine itself, we did a visual simulation to look at what it would look like if fully built out at 151 acres. And it is tiers of stone cutting into the mountain, taking the summit out. And the lease in this case was for 99 years. So this destruction was going to continue for a long time.
You describe what you saw at the time that you got involved as a deep orange wound in the side of the mountain, fully visible from this the Appalachian Trail. And you just mentioned that this lease was for 99 years. This is a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week operation, dusty, very noisy. And you talk in the book a little bit about your impact and that of your dog on this constant noise.
It's unbelievable. It was to me the impact that the noise had on me hearing this. And they did not work 24 hours a day in this startup phase. But when they pull a shot of dynamite 3 miles away across the valley, the whole valley shudders. And my dogs would bark at the sky. If any of the listeners have dogs, you know that there are certain noises that are particularly aggravating to dogs' ears. Well, my dog Biscuit just couldn't stand this constant racket. And at the backup beeper, she would lift her head up constantly and look around and then look to me, wondering why I hadn't done anything about it.
But this is going on in other places around the mountains. Why was this one so troublesome?
I think because this place is particularly quiet. This place is particularly scenic. This place has particularly high conservation value. This is a place that generations of botanists from the 1700s have called sacred ground. And when you have these inconsistent uses in those sacred places, it raises the ire in a particular way because the expectations are so high for someone who travels from Singapore, as a man recently did, to photograph Gray's lilies on these grassy balds. Your expectations are for a silent, special, different place. And when that is shattered, it hurts more.
So you go to this first county commission meeting, and the Cox Cook clan, these are the people that called you, gave you documents and photographs and laid out violations of the Mining Act, making specific allegations in what you describe as lurid detail, including the fact that the mining company built a haul road to get the gravel off the mountain without any say-so from the Department of Transportation, including how it connected to a road that the Department of Transportation owned and operated. These folks, these simple mountain people with a dial-up internet connection, a 14-year-old girl did an incredible amount of work. Why did they need you? I mean, with that information, why wasn't that enough to stop this operation that very night?
With that information, they were writing letters to the Division of Land Resources, and those were getting put in a stack of letters and being put away in a file drawer, and no action was being taken in response. And they felt they had already lost. By the time they met me, they had already compiled all this evidence. They had photographs. They had documented the dates and times. They had underlined relevant sections of the Mining Act. They handed it to me, and I saw that they were right and that they were not having their concerns addressed. And when I went to Raleigh, things started to change. Not because I'm not a simple person from the mountains necessarily, but because I was standing there in their presence, and Ashley and Ollie had never traveled more than 4 miles away with their claims.
Wow. You also discovered that under North Carolina law, an applicant, this is a quote, an applicant seeking a mining permit must first notify all owners of record of land adjoining the proposed mining site of their right to seek a public hearing. And that, too, was ignored?
In this case, the applicant pulled the permit boundary in 50 feet off their property line, and then must have stood back, I imagine, standing in the sunlight with the map laid out and said, aha, we don't join anybody in the meaning of the statute. So none of the 16 adjoining landowners to this site received public notice of their right to seek a public hearing.
Is that why a public hearing was never
That held? Is why a public hearing was never held.
Now, you're an environmentalist, and you tried to enlist the help of several environmental groups in your effort to shut down this mine. They were reluctant to get involved. Why?
I think because environmental and conservation nonprofits have very focused missions. They're always having to watch their budgets, and when they get dragged off their mission, it is dangerous mm-hmm. for a nonprofit. You can anger your constituency.
We will talk about one of the nonprofits that did get involved in a second or two with Jay Lutze, the author of Stand Up That Mountain. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Community Blood Center of the Carolinas, blood supplier to 21 of the region's hospitals. Local donors help meet blood needs as the summer supply drops and demand increases. CBCC.us. And Audi of Charlotte presenting a selection of luxury vehicles committed to customer service and satisfaction. East Independence Boulevard inside the 485 Beltway. Audi, truth in engineering. Information at AudiofCharlotte.com. The National Security Agency surveillance network can tap into about 75% of all U.S. internet traffic. New details on how the program operates and its reach into the communications of ordinary Americans coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. By the way, our guest today, Jay Lutze, is going to be signing his book at Park Road Books tonight at 7 o'clock, and you can find information about that on our website at wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Ah, my first car. It was a 62 Chevy Bel Air. Oh, it was magnificent.
Hi, it's us, Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers.
No, it was a piece of junk. In fact, this car had the dubious distinction of using more oil than it did gasoline. I'd pull into the gas station and I'd say, fill the oil and check the gas. Now, wouldn't it be great if even a car like that could be turned into the programs that you love?
Call 1-866-789-8627.
Or go to WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Jay Lutze is our guest. His book is called Stand Up That Mountain, The Battle to Save One Small Community in the Wilderness Along the Appalachian Trail, which is up in Avery County. We've been talking about that. And we talked just before the break about the environmental group, because you're an environmentalist and you try to engage other environmental organizations in your effort to save this mountain, to stop this mine. And most of them said no. But the Southern Environmental Law Center in Charlottesville agreed to represent you and your neighbors at no charge. Why, if the other ones were afraid about being pulled off their mission and expending money on things other than their mission, why did these folks get involved?
Because I finally found the group whose mission it is to do exactly this thing. And when I met the lead attorney for the Carolinas office in Chapel Hill, Tripp Van Oppen, Tripp said, Jay, we can only take cases that will set a precedent. And I said, well, in this case, the gentleman that issued the permit, Charles Gardner, told me he would not have issued it had he known where the Appalachian Trail was. Now, that's what you would have found out had public hearings been held. Mm-hmm. And Tripp Van Oppen heard that, and he said that would set a precedent. And that's how he became my lawyer.
Now, you had gone to the mountains. I don't know how soon after graduation from law school you went, but you went to the mountains to write novels, to write fiction, to write the great American novel. And you get this phone call from a 14-year-old, and you become involved in this. This didn't take a month or two. This took 5 years. And you footed the bill for much of this. I mean, how did you do it? Why did you do it?
Well, it's one of, you hear this said sometimes, I could do no other. When I sat down with Ollie Cox, the 14-year-old girl's aunt who was raising her, and she was raising her because her father was a meth dealer, and there was hardship in this family. And Ollie Cox told me she had never won at anything, and she was afraid to start this fight. And I thought,
Ollie had never won?
Ollie said she had never won at anything. And I looked at my life experience, and I thought, well, I'm not used to losing. In some ways, I had had a privileged upbringing, and I was fascinated that someone could look at their life that way when I knew already how bright she was and that she had the ability with her niece to put together all this evidence. And I thought right then, you are going to win at this because you're right and I am going to help. Mm.
But you went up there to write. You had not been, you had not published the great American novel. You had not been chosen by Oprah's Book Club. to the best of my knowledge, you didn't have a job except to write. So how did you do it? How did you feed yourself?
Well, as I like to say,
this is a great deal of effort here.
Well, people who are not in the studio today might not have the same understanding that Mike has, that I cut my own hair.
You do? It's a great haircut. Can you stay after and cut mine?
I cut my own hair. I took showers in the dark. I pinched pennies. I cut back on everything that I did. I had saved a little money from a job that I had for 2 years, and I thought that's how long it would take to produce a great novel and start receiving royalty checks. I miscalculated terribly. But I lived simply. I didn't have a mortgage, and I had to feed my dogs, and I had to keep leader on my trout line. And other than that, I lived a simple life. I still do.
This struggle took 5 years. You faced a lot of tough obstacles, not the least of which was the fact that no mining permit in North Carolina had ever been revoked by the state. And I guess they gave this permit, as you said, because they didn't know precisely where it was located. Even when they found out, was it difficult to revoke the mining license?
Yes. It was. It's astonishing how much effort and money and political willpower it takes to do the right thing once the right thing is clearly laid out in front of you. But I have to say I admire the state officials that took this seriously, embarked on a process, revoked the permit, and then defended the revocation with everything they had right up to the North Carolina Attorney General's office and the governor's office with support from the United States Department of the Interior.
How remarkable was it to get the support of the Department of the Interior?
Well, I write about the night that Pam Underhill arrived in Avery County to speak at our public hearing, and Charles Gardner, who issued the permits, eyes grew as big as dinner plates.
Just because she was there?
Because she was there, and then she spoke with eloquence on behalf of the people of the United States with her desire that the state restart this process and let it unfold properly. And I looked at Ollie Cox, and she could not believe that this woman had flown in from somewhere, the Pentagon, the White House. I could see her mind whirling because here was this woman speaking on her behalf, not only to protect the Appalachian Trail, but to protect the community of Dogtown.
Dogtown is what they call the – it's not on a map, right?
That's right.
That's what they call where they live. I had a question, and it's gone away, but let me bring up a different question here. Let's go back to the Department of the Interior, because it seems to me that the Department of the Interior is there to protect things like the Appalachian Trail and the Blue Ridge Parkway and things like that. Why couldn't they have shut it down right then, on the spot?
That's a great question, and that did take me right back to law school, my first year in law school where you study standing. The people with standing to bring this complaint were the people denied their right to a public hearing in the first place. The Appalachian National Scenic Trail was not technically an adjoining landowner under the statute as it was written then. It is now. But this whole case could not have even been heard had Ollie Cox, the adjoining landowner, not stood up and used her standing as an adjoining landowner to get us all into court. The whole case rested on her shoulders.
Not even the federal government could get involved because
that's exactly
it's a North
right.
Carolina statute. But this is a federal trail. The Appalachian Trail goes to many, many states. It's an interstate highway for walkers.
That's right.
So why don't they have jurisdiction?
Had the mining operation been on land owned by Pisgah National Forest, they would have had jurisdiction. This was about a quarter of a mile outside the proclamation boundary for the National Forest.
Aunt Ollie's home foundation had been cracked by blasting at the mine, a blast that you felt in your cabin, which was on another mountain, wasn't it, on the other side?
On another ridge of the same mountain.
Okay. But that claim, the fact that they cracked her foundation when they set off that blast, that is not why you won this case. You won because of the proximity to the Appalachian Trail. What does that say about our courts, our system of law, the way we think that beauty is more important than personal property damaged by somebody's blasting?
I think we do not have tools and we do not have vocabulary to find expression for the fact that those things are so deeply connected, that our place and the water that we drink and who we are one and the same thing. We had to find a legal theory that would win. And Ollie Cox is just as happy that we won the case based on protection of what she called that little dirt trail up on the hill as she would have been had she been the reason that we won. It was enough for her that she is the reason we got into court. The court then found that the state had violated the Mining Act by not giving deference to the National Park Unit and that it would have significant adverse effects on that National Park Unit. That is a reason they could have denied the permit, but they didn't know it. So that is how the case was resolved.
Mohammed in Charlotte emails, I visit the Roans and Grandfather Mountain multiple times a year and had no idea this was happening in Appalachia. Are there other mountaintops being mined or defaced that we can protect?
Yes. The more common situation is where we are making land use decisions that are harming very high conservation value because we do not have zoning and regional planning in our mountains. So each community is in sort of a race to build its tax base as high as it can, and there is often little regard for what we're doing to the landscape in general. So
the poverty is so extreme up there. Don't they have to build their tax base?
That's an important argument that often gets made. What a lot of communities have done, Mike, is expand their infrastructure in a race to increase their tax base. And what they end up doing is having to build a new school or new roads or new sewer systems, new police protection to new areas, and you end up chasing your tail. Mm-hmm. So the wise thing for communities to do is to plan their future around their best resources. Now, unfortunately, North Carolina just eliminated its Mountain Resources Commission, which was set up for this very purpose, to identify where the key resources are, whether they're scenic resources or great places to build homes, great places to build golf courses, great places to mine for various minerals. And this was a regional approach to figuring out what we have and how best to use it in the future so we don't squander it. And unfortunately, that commission was disbanded.
By this recent legislature?
By this legislature.
Let's talk about that for a second. Politics seems to be in dire straits recently with, you know, everybody's at loggerheads. And there is a school of thought, and there's been a big push from that school of thought, to limit government regulation as much as possible. The claim being, of course, that regulations hurt business and that if left to their own devices, business will act in the best interest of everyone because it would be bad for business if they didn't. And here's a case where that clearly did not happen. Is this just a fluke or an example of what does happen when business does what they're in the business to do, make money?
Well, I'll tell you, Mike, that during the case, I spent a lot of time in Raleigh within the state agencies that issue various permits. And they are feeling under enormous pressure to do their work well with less staff and less funding, and frankly, with less support from people that direct them how to do their jobs. As I mentioned earlier, when I was a kid, there were 3 million people living in North Carolina. There are now 9 million. We all want access to clean drinking water, to healthy air to breathe. That supports our critical tourism industry. Up in my neck of the woods, that's the trout fishing industry, for one. Hunting is a big sport that draws a lot of revenue into our region. And bird watching, for example, is another one. So how are you going to protect the ability for people to make their livelihood off of industries that are sustainable if you don't have some shared set of rules? We're drinking water here in Charlotte that originated up by the Blue Ridge Parkway. And how are you going to know that your upstream neighbor is treating that water well so that it doesn't cost you more down here to clean water once it's been impaired? We have tools. We're smart enough to know how to do this, but we have to have a collective will to reduce the costs on everyone and share the burdens of providing a clean place for us to raise families and go about our business and still have places that inspire us and are just special to be in.
I think this whole conversation has been an example of what I said at the beginning, that this was going to be a conversation about good intentions and unintended consequences. And this is kind of the icing on that cake. The fact that your book, Stand Up That Mountain, has now become used as a textbook on environmental studies at universities, literally as a textbook. How did that happen?
Word of mouth. The book is being passed around. People who relate to this 14-year-old girl, Ashley, people who relate to Ollie, who said she'd never wanted anything, people are finding things in this story that are relevant to their own concerns, whether it's siting of landfills, living in close proximity to coal ash ponds, siting of fracking operations, which is something that has a lot of attention these days, siting of wind turbines, and the impact that that has on people who live nearby. So the book has been found by students, and I think that they're going to professors saying, let's study this. Mm. So that's a lot of what I've been doing this year is traveling to universities.
And you've said that this experience has changed your view of the justice system. How?
My view of the justice system has I believe what my friend Robert Crable told me, that the right side usually wins eventually if you can stay in court long enough. And that gets down to resources. We were able to stay in this course, in this case, for the 5 years that it took to win it because the Southern Environmental Law Center worked for free. If we were paying attorneys, they submitted me a bill for $374,000 at the end of the case just to demonstrate how much work had gone into it. And I didn't have to pay that, thank goodness, because I couldn't have. But a lot of people who are similarly situated to Ashley and Ollie cannot afford to be in court for 4 years.
But Paul Brown could?
Paul Brown could. And the state of North Carolina could.
After he was forced to close this mine, I'm told that he tried to open it again in a new location 6 miles to the south, no longer near the Appalachian Trail, but this time near the Blue Ridge Parkway. What happened?
By that time, the Mining Act of 1971 had been revised, and there were new levels of notice required, and the Blue Ridge Parkway administrator got notice of that operation, and that permit under the new Mining Act that was improved after our case was denied before it was issued.
And what about Ollie and Ashley? Their foundation was cracked on their house. What has happened to them in the interim?
They are strong, resilient people. I can tell you that right now they're facing the threat of a cut that Paul Brown's mining company made behind their house. When Ashley's father sold his land, they have a landslide behind their house that is now threatening the foundation that they had shored up. And they are facing it the way they face everything. They will win.
Wow. You've changed their outlook on life, then, it sounds like. Jay Lutze's book is called Stand Up That Mountain, The Battle to Save One Small Community in the Wilderness Along the Appalachian Trail. Great book. Thank you for the hour.
Thank you, Mike.